If you need to make it higher or lower, depending on your preference. And the final reminder, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before beginning your argument. And that's for our recording purposes. With that said, I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case for our hearing and consideration.
A23-0884, Brian Rhodes et al. Appellants versus Stockwell Homes LLC et al. Respondents.
And when you're ready, go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
May it please the court, my name is Monica Davies and I represent the appellants in this matter, Brian and Brianna Rhodes. The Minnesota Civil Mediation Act requires a party signature to form a mediated settlement agreement. There is none in the record. Nobody disputes that there's no written settlement agreement signed by the parties. Nobody disputes that there's no written settlement agreement even signed by counsel for the parties, leaving aside whether that would be appropriate in the first place. In fact, the only way the district court was able to find that an enforceable settlement agreement exists was to rely on a series of assumptions about an imagined email that has never been part of the record. The court, in its order, expressly acknowledged that it did not actually have an email from appellant's counsel, but it assumed it must have existed and further assumed it must have contained an acceptance of the mediator's proposal. The court went further and assumed that the hypothetical email must have also included a signature block from appellant's counsel, which, again, the court assumed appellant's counsel had adopted as an electronic signature. But the only email from appellant's counsel that actually exists in the record is an email that expressly rejects the proposed settlement and confirms that appellants were unable to accept the mediator's described terms. It would be unprecedented for this court to enforce a settlement agreement where none exists in the record.
Counsel, and
yes, ma'am.
Before we get to the question of what the factual record provides, I think the threshold legal question is what does signed by the parties mean within the context of the Civil Mediation Act? And it strikes me, and this is not raised by the parties, but it strikes me that essentially, the parties are arguing the statute is ambiguous, that it's susceptible to two reasonable interpretations. The first being that signed by the parties means the litigants, and the second is signed by the parties means the litigants or their duly appointed representative, an attorney, which is a procedure that's allowed by Section 481 of the Minnesota statutes. How are we to resolve that ambiguity when there's ostensibly two reasonable interpretations of the statute?
Appellants do not believe that the Civil Mediation Act is ambiguous in this regard. The statute specifically calls for a settlement agreement, a written settlement agreement, to be signed and dated by the parties. And that's the position that appellants have consistently taken in this matter.
But what does that mean?
By the parties, the litigants themselves.
That's not defined in the Act, though, right? Does the Civil Mediation Act define who the parties are?
I'd have to look back specifically at the definition of the parties, but if Your Honor will give me just a moment, I can look to what was cited in our briefs. Our position has always been that the parties are the litigants identified in the caption, and there is no...
I understand the argument. I think that... We, you know, as I said, I think we're faced with two interpretations of what signed by the parties means. And in order for us to resolve what that actually means, I think we need to look at canons of statutory construction and other issues of, you know, that we look to for statutory interpretation.
We would argue that given the statute's focus on making sure that there are statements within a mediated settlement agreement confirming that the parties are aware that they are, that signing an agreement may affect their legal rights and that they're aware they have the opportunity to consult with counsel and should consult with counsel before signing any such agreement, indicates that the statute is intended to have the parties themselves, the litigants themselves, sign. If an attorney were able to sign on their behalf, there would be no guarantee or indication or any assurance whatsoever that the parties, the litigants themselves, were in fact receiving those warnings and those that guidance that the statute calls for.
But isn't that part of the obligation under Section 481, where an attorney is required to provide the client with full disclosures and can only act on behalf of the client with the client's consent and agreement?
481 certainly allows the attorneys to act on behalf of their clients, but we would argue that the requirements of Civil Mediation Act go further than Section 481 does in terms of setting forth what specifically the litigants are to be advised of and how specifically the litigants are to be warned that signing a mediated settlement agreement would affect their legal position.
So, I mean, there is a difference between getting the parties to agree and understand what is at stake in a mediation, and I think that the statute makes that clear. But as a practical matter, I mean, I used to do this all the time when I was a practitioner and when I would mediate cases when I was a district court judge. Settlements don't always happen at the date and time of the mediation. They can continue, and the mediator can continue and often does continue to make efforts after the mediation, after the parties go home, they think about it for a while, and then usually, typically, the offer is extended to the attorneys communicate to the clients respond to the attorneys respond to the mediator. And that's how agreements are reached. There's no signing of any documents by the parties until well after everything is put to paper, after the terms have been settled and there's negotiation over the precise language. It seems to me that the construction that you are advocating here would turn that entire practice, that entire mediation practice, on its head. Why is it that we should upset the apple cart in that way?
It's a fair question, and under the circumstances, I can certainly appreciate where Your Honor is going or coming from. In this case, again, we stand by the position that the litigants themselves are required to sign. But even if we grant the assumption that an attorney can somehow bind their parties or their clients to a settlement agreement, there's no attorney signature in the record either. And there's no indication here that appellant's counsel on appellant's behalf bound the appellants to an enforceable settlement.
I don't disagree with you. That's a separate question. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to focus on this statutory interpretation question, how you want us to construct the Civil Mediation Act. Any other reasons why we should construe the act in the way that you're suggesting?
I would suggest that the Civil Mediation Act is to be applied pursuant to its plain language, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated as much, even where it seems that it may lead to unintended consequences. Similar to a case involving the statute of frauds, there are certain circumstances where the signatures of the parties to the transaction themselves, rather than their legal counsel, need to sign to protect everybody's interest, to make sure that everybody is clear as to what is being agreed to, and to make sure that the actual parties involved, the litigants involved, understand what it is that they're gaining and what it is that they're giving up. And the Civil Mediation Act, the fact that it does specifically call for these specific warnings and the parties to be advised of the consequences of signing an agreement, goes a step beyond what common law agency might suggest or what Section 481 suggests in terms of an attorney's general authority to bind their client.
Well, with that said, turn your attention, if you will, to your assertion that Civil Mediation Act only applies to settlement agreements that are placed of record in court. What about the second part of the language that says, or made in writing and signed by the attorney? I mean, that seems to be a missing piece in terms of your argument, because that is a second way of having the settlement agreement enforced.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you point me to where the language that you're referring to as
Your argument is that attorneys can bind their clients to an agreement signed in writing, and then you argue that the statute applies only to settlements that are entered into an agreement of record in court. But the settlement agreement does go on, and I'm asking you to acknowledge that, to say that or by an attorney in writing after the fact.
I don't believe we've taken the position that the attorney can sign the settlement on.
So your argument then has to do with the electronic signature only?
That is part of our argument, yes. The assuming that we allow for the argument that an attorney can sign on their client's behalf and bind them to a mediated settlement agreement,
Then that's the second part of your argument, is then that the attorney is prohibited from binding a client because of using an electronic signature?
No, not that using an electronic signature would be prohibited, but rather there is no evidence in this case that an electronic signature in the way contemplated by the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act was in fact subscribed to or adopted.
Are you saying it doesn't exist or that it was deficient?
An electronic signature sufficient to bind the parties does not exist in this case.
Right.
That's not what the district court found, though.
Correct. And that's one of the reasons that we view the district court's ruling to be erroneous and feel that it should be reversed.
Now, the parties were advised during the mediation of all the things you talked about the warnings the importance of reviewing everything, right?
In the mediation agreement that was signed at the beginning of mediation, those acknowledgments were included, yes.
Okay.
Does anybody have this email?
No, it is not in the record.
It's not in the record, but does somebody have it?
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that. I came into this case for purposes of this appeal, and my knowledge, just like the court's, is limited to what's been in the record. I have not seen any such email.
In the pleading part of this, where it's alleged that there is this writing, I mean, did you emphatically assert that there is no such document?
We did, yes. And before the district court, when respondents moved for summary judgment, they included as part of their argument the notion that this alleged settlement agreement should be enforced, and we took the position at that point that there was
Let's
no
just
evidence.
Be straight. We're talking about the email that the mediator sent that supposedly was returned by both attorneys indicating a preference.
The mediator's email setting forth his proposals is part of the record. What is not part of the record and what the district court relied on in determining that an enforceable settlement agreement exists is an email from appellant's counsel that the district court assumed must exist and assumed must have set forth appellant's acceptance of the mediator's terms and assumed it included an electronic signature sufficient to qualify, to bind
the clients. What about the mediator's follow-up email to the parties indicating that there was some minor adjustments that were fair? I mean, it would seem that implies that there was a consent to the option.
It certainly implies that the mediator had communicated with the parties, but we don't know the content of any such communication. There isn't any indication that there was written confirmation of an acceptance of the terms, and quite frankly, we don't know if the mediator's subsequent email was based on accurate information or not. The only email from appellant's counsel that is part of the record regarding the settlement is the email in which he specifically states that appellants are unable to accept the settlement's terms.
The court says in its order that Mr. Shanus's acceptance of the mediator's proposal was doubtless included in the email body. So what you're saying for summary judgment purposes, that would not be appropriate?
Correct. The court was assuming the existence of evidence that was not in the record. And as the non-moving parties, the appellants were entitled to the resolution of any inferences in their favor. Instead, what the district court did was make inferences and a series of assumptions against appellants in order to find a basis on which to grant respondents' motion. And it's on that basis that we would suggest that the district court erred and ask that its ruling be reversed.
Two questions. Was there discovery in this case?
There was some amount of discovery. There were depositions. I'm not privy to the details of that discovery, but I do know that there was no demand as part of discovery for any email communications between Mr. Shanus and the mediator.
You assert that that has to be an email? Could it be a phone conversation in which the attorney accepted the agreement?
I do not believe a phone conversation would suffice because of the requirements of the Civil Mediation Act that we've discussed and the assumption that there was an email was one that was made by the district court, again, without any admissible evidence in the record on which to do so. And unless the court has any further questions, I will save my additional remarks for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Davies.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Nimchek. I'm the attorney for the respondents, Stockwell Homes, LLC, and Jennifer Stockwell. May it please the court, the purpose of mediation is to help parties reach a settlement of their dispute, and that's exactly what happened here. Two parties.
Did it happen? I mean, I don't know if it happened. What does the email say?
Yeah, I have some things to say about that. There was... And I wasn't involved either at the district court level in creating the record, but here's what the record does reflect. A motion for summary judgment brought by my client asserting that there was a settlement agreement. It was confirmed by these emails. The mediator confirmed that a settlement agreement had been reached. That was the summary judgment motion. If the other side had wanted to deny that such an email exists, they had the opportunity to do so.
I mean, I get the district court level. I mean, I really do. I understand it. But there is an email. It came from a lawyer. It went to Mr. Cook, who was the mediator. It says something. I don't know why the district court didn't have it, and I don't know why we don't. I mean, we're fighting over something that is a knowable fact that nobody seems to want to disclose, and I don't understand that.
Right.
What does that email say?
Based on how the mediator describes it, the email reflects agreement to an option A 11 bullet point deal that was laid out in great detail by the mediator's earlier email.
I understand what Mr. Cook says in his email. What does the actual email that was delivered to Mr. Cook say?
We do not have that email, Your Honor.
Nobody's got it.
Well, presumably Mr. Shanis has it.
But that's what we're troubled with, because the court decides and states plaintiffs cannot defeat the presumption that a settlement agreement is valid by merely asserting that no signed writing exists. How can that happen at summary judgment? Isn't that a lot of credibility determinations as to who said what or where it is?
Well, the way that the summary judgment...
Why does the court call it a presumption?
Well, because here there was a motion brought that there was an agreement. If there wasn't, because there was no email, it was incumbent on the other side to say that, to deny it, to submit a declaration saying this email does not exist, it didn't happen.
I don't think that's right. I mean, your client moved for enforcement of a settlement agreement, and it's your burden to establish that a settlement agreement existed. And I don't think that in the absence of an offer, an acceptance, an offer and an acceptance, that there can be evidence of a meeting of the mind such that a settlement agreement was reached. Or if the lawyer is accepting a mediated settlement agreement on behalf of the client, there should be evidence that the lawyer is accepting a mediated settlement agreement on behalf of the client.
And the evidence here in the record, Your Honor, is the mediator's third-party outside confirmation that there was such an acceptance.
So I'm troubled by that, too, because the mediator's response to the parties indicates that there's some additional term, which at least suggests to me that there wasn't an offer and an acceptance based on the precise terms that were floated. So there's something in addition there. And then immediately there's a, no, we don't have a deal. So I'm not entirely sure that Mr. Cook's email with the additional term is a real deal.
I can only say, Your Honor, that it appears that the additional term he was referencing was an extremely minor term in the 11-point extremely detailed.
Minor to who? To him?
That it was, well, that it wasn't at the center.
The parties?
To anyone.
Well, how do we know that? How do we know that it was minor to the parties?
well, the way that Mr. Cook presented it in his email was that this is going to be part of the deal, no arguments. That,
I know, he's interested in getting the deal done.
Yes.
I mean, I read all of his emails. He was very interested in getting this deal done.
He does send interesting emails, but that his emails are comprehensive and clear that he, when he sent out these terms that were detailed and specific, that if he got yeses on the specific option A, there would be a deal. He said that. And then he reported later, good news, guys, I got a yeses from both parties on an option A deal. And there's this little extra thing that you're all going to agree to because it's minor. That's how I read his response. And I want to return to this idea of this motion being for summary judgment. The motion was that there was a deal confirmed by email. If there wasn't, it's
so
incumbent
in this,
upon
in this
them.
Email that nobody has seen. What, when Cook sent it back, he talked about some other, I don't know, some, I hate the word tweak, but there were some other things that needed to go in there. Doesn't that mean that maybe there's not clarity? How do we know what he's talking about?
Well, he says what he's talking about. He says it has to.
He's saying it's minimal, but we don't know that because we don't know what it is.
Well, he says what it is, Your Honor.
What's that?
It was the idea that if payment is not timely made, that the that at that point the non-disparagement clause would, that was already part of the deal, wouldn't be enforceable.
Let me ask you a different question, one that wasn't specifically raised but is of concern to me.
I'm sorry, I'm
going to ask you a different question or on a different subject that wasn't specifically raised but is of concern to me. So it's my understanding that Mr. Rhodes was present at the mediation. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he signed the disclosure, the mediation, or the agreement to mediate.
Yes.
But Ms. Rhodes was not?
So I read in the record, too.
Okay. So how could she be bound to any mediation agreement if she did not sign the disclosure?
Well, the idea here is that her spouse was acting as her agent in that regard.
And where's that in the record?
That is not something that's been argued, so it's not something in the record. There was not been a claim by the other side that there never could have been a deal because Mrs. Rhodes didn't sign the wasn't present at the mediation itself. I guess we can only assume that when Mr. Shanis got authority from his clients to respond to Mr. Cook's mediation proposal, that he, because he's a lawyer and presumably wouldn't act otherwise, had the authority from all his clients to agree to something.
So this is sort of a variation on a theme that I think that Judge Werke was focused in on, and that is we're dealing with a lot of assumptions here, and this is a dispositive motion before the district court. And I speak on behalf of myself and not my colleagues, although I suspect they might agree. I'm troubled by the lack of a record upon which the district court, that the district court had, and the decisions that the district court made in the absence of a detailed record. How is it that we can review these findings when we don't have a record? And neither did the district court.
The way that they should be viewed, in our view, is that without a denial of the idea that there was a written emailed acceptance, the assertion that it's an undisputed fact that there was an acceptance based on the mediator's statement is something that the court can rely upon. There was an easy way to stop this motion from succeeding. If true, Mr. Shanis could have denied that there was an email sent. I just now was reviewing his declaration. It's not there. He does not deny that such an email was sent. That would have been something that would have created a disputed issue of genuine material fact about the question of acceptance if it were there. It's not. They didn't deny then. You can look closely at their memorandum or their legal briefs before this court. There is not a denial that such an email exists. There's simply they continually observe that it's not part of the record. It certainly was in their power to deny it or to put in that email if it was anything other than the acceptance or exactly what is reflected by what Mr. Cook said. But I can imagine that my predecessor as counsel for my clients probably would have had difficulty getting a confidential communication between lawyer and mediator as part of any sort of discovery, and instead relied upon the mediator's confirmation. No one accuses the mediator of lying, of fabricating the idea that there was a settlement. That's not part of, that's not been argued. That's not part of the record either. All there is an assertion that this is an undisputed fact, that there was acceptance of this deal via email, and a non-denial that such an acceptance was sent, received, was what the mediator reported as having been accepted actually happened. And that's how the court gets to a point where, okay, this is an undisputed fact, because it wasn't disputed. There's just been this...
they even had a basis upon which they could make any such argument. I mean, the way that this was presented to the district court procedurally seems also quite odd. There was no discovery about this issue. There was a hearing, and then the district court says, after the fact, you can submit additional documents. Some additional documents were submitted to the district court, but there was no compelled exchange between the parties in terms of discovery. So it does seem to me difficult that you're sort of in a difficult position to make this argument, because there wasn't an opportunity for everyone to figure out what actually happened in this context. So how do we deal with that?
Well, as I understand it, the parties, when they initially submitted their motion papers on both sides, were very careful not to include confidential communications and the exact terms of the settlement proposal, the option A, for reasons relating to concerns about mediator confidentiality. And then at the hearing, the district court said, I got to see what these terms were to determine whether they're specific enough, whether it's something I can actually enforce. And then the parties through their lawyers got together and agreed upon the submission of additional record materials, which, as I review it, is basically the option A and the option B, such as it was, that are now part of the record and were submitted later. This was something that was agreed upon. I don't know the content of those discussions and whether they included a discussion about, hey, Mr. Shanus, where's your acceptance email? When the motion was brought, the idea was that Mr. Cook's in writing assertion that such an acceptance existed is good enough. And without any denial, there's no basis for inferring that such an email doesn't exist.
Tell me then what the Court of Appeal standard of review would be in this kind of a matter. The enforcement of a settlement agreement. What's our standard of review?
Your Honor, like any summary judgment, it's de novo. There's a presumption that settlement agreements are valid, but a motion to enforce a settlement agreement is a motion for summary judgment, and it's reviewed under the same standard as it would be for any other summary judgment before the court.
And when we consider Mr. McGrath's response email, the ultimate response email saying, my clients don't agree to the terms, how do we reconcile that email with the paragraph towards the end of the district court's order, which indicates that a lawyer must have the client's consent in order to act on the client's behalf? Doesn't that record indicate that perhaps this lawyer may not have had the client's consent to accept the settlement agreement?
I can only say, Your Honor, that argument has not been made. There's been no assertion by anyone that Mr. Shanus was acting beyond his authority, that the Rhodeses were somehow confused or were duped by their lawyer, or that they didn't tell their lawyer to communicate their acceptance on their behalf.
You just said this was de novo review, though.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You just said this was de novo review. So on a de novo review of the file, if there's some question about whether the lawyer had legal authority to act on behalf of the client, then why wouldn't we be able to rule on that issue on de novo review?
Thus my question on our standard of review. You can't have it both ways.
And I don't think we are, Your Honor. It's just that no argument has been made by the parties who would know. We're not privy to what Mr. Shanus and his clients might have discussed what was authorized or what wasn't. But no one has come forward, either Mr. Shaines or his client, saying that they were somehow not on the same page. I read Mr. Shaines's "we don't have a deal" response as his clients changing their mind. He didn't say in that email, "Whoa, wait a minute, Mr. Cook, we didn't actually agree to that," or "Whoa, wait a minute, we can't agree to things by email," or "Whoa, my client has to sign anything before it's final." It just says, "Well, I guess we don't have a deal. My clients have changed their minds." That's my interpretation of what he wrote, and the fact that 24 hours passed between when Mr. Cook sent his confirmation email and when the response came from opposing counsel saying, "Well, sorry, I guess we don't have a deal." He even apologized, or regrettably, I think was his word. So in our view, there was consent, there was acceptance. There was acceptance in writing by the lawyer, and I see my time is up, Your Honors, and unless there's any other questions,
I'll... I have a question. You acknowledge that if there's no email, there's no deal. If there's no email from the Rhodes attorney, there's no deal, correct?
Yes, the statute requires a signed writing from the party, or as we say, and we never reached this point, or from their duly authorized attorney acting on their behalf.
And the only evidence of the email is what the mediator is saying, that there was an email.
Yes.
But there's no email in the record.
We have the mediator saying there was an email and a lack of denial that there was from the other side. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. I'd like to just touch.
And I'd like to ask you the question too. What do you assert is our standard of review? Is it de novo?
It is. I'd like to just touch on a couple of points that were made during respondent's argument. First, as it relates to the mediator's email, to be clear, even the mediator's email does not indicate that there was any email from appellant's counsel, that there was a written acceptance of any terms from appellant's counsel, or the content of any such communication. The mediator simply said, "I have heard from both parties in a reasonably timely manner," and went on to say that there was agreement as to option A. We don't know.
To be clear, you're denying that there was an email, or you're denying that the email accepted the terms of option A? Or?
I simply don't know. Again, my knowledge is limited to what's in the record, and more importantly, the district court's knowledge is limited to what's in the record. So for the district court to make the series of assumptions that it did.
The argument is that you have to affirmatively disavow that there was any such thing. I mean, that's what I'm hearing.
I heard the same, and I would again reiterate, and before the district court, in the course of the summary judgment briefing, appellants did consistently take the position that there was no agreement that had been reached. As it relates to the existence of the email specifically.
That's different than denying that there was an email.
You're right, and at the time that the motion was being briefed, and even during oral argument, at the time of oral argument, this issue as to the existence of this email and whether it exists, and if so, what it says, hadn't really come to fruition. And as the court noted, the procedural timeline was a bit odd in that evidence was submitted after the fact, and there was no follow-up in terms of additional briefing or additional discovery. And at that point, you know, given the way things that transpired, appellants couldn't have foreseen that the court would have made the assumptions that it did and go to the lengths that it did in order to find an enforceable agreement. But at the end of the day, and I believe the court noted, proving the existence of a settlement agreement is respondent's burden. They need to prove that the contract exists. They need to prove that there's a valid signature. The reasons that they can't, perhaps it relates to the confidentiality of the underlying settlement communications. Perhaps it relates to, we just simply don't know. There wasn't any discovery effort taken. But the fact is that there is no email in the record there on which the court based its decision. There is no written settlement agreement signed by any party. The mediator's, even assume the mediator's email indicating that there had been agreement, even in and of itself, contemplated that there would be future writings signed by the parties, including a written settlement agreement, including a confession of judgment. And the fact that those additional steps were contemplated is further underscores the notion that there was no electronic signature intended and that would have the ability to bind the parties to an enforceable mediated settlement agreement at that time.
Are you representing to the court that there is no email?
I don't know. I'm not, I cannot make a representation as to either way. I have not seen any such email, and I have only reviewed the record that's before the court.
So I presume that discovery is closed in this case.
That is my understanding. I do not know for sure.
So assume that we say, you're right, there's no email in the record, there's no documentation that we have or that the district court had that establishes a settlement agreement. Would you oppose reopening discovery so that the parties can determine whether there is a document that exists that would indicate that there's some settlement?
I believe we would, for the same reasons that we have taken the position that even assuming an email exists, it's not a basis on which to find an enforceable mediated settlement agreement.
And say we disagree with that. Would you still oppose it? Would you still oppose more discovery to determine whether there was an agreement, an email?
If the court were to rule that...
That an email or that an attorney can bind a client to a mediated settlement agreement?
I don't know that I can take a position on additional discovery at this time, but our argument remains the same, that as a matter of law, even assuming such an email exists, it wouldn't comply with the requirements of the Civil Mediation Act.
I understand.
Thank you. Absent any further questions from the court, I think I will end my remarks.
And I would like to thank both counsel thank you. I would like to thank both counsel for your arguments today. They certainly assist in our deliberative process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, the matter is deemed submitted, and a decision will be issued in the statutory time.